Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, welcome to Teach Me to Talk with Laura and Kate. I'm Laura Mize. I'm a pediatric speech language pathologist. I could barely say that today. I think I might need a speech therapist myself before it's over. If you're listening right now on Friday, September 5th at 1 o'clock Eastern Time, you're listening live, we would absolutely love for you to call into the show. Our call-in number is 718-766-4332, and we would love to hear from you today. Kate, are you there?
I'm here.
I didn't even hear you click on today. That was
I was
cool.
I was quiet. That's not my norm, is it?
No,
you,
I can't believe it. Oh, let's get started. Today's show, we're going to talk about working toward intelligible speech in toddlers. And I think that's a real common concern that parents have for their kids. First, we want them to talk, and then they're worried about that they can't really understand a lot of what they say. Do you hear that a lot, Kate?
I do, and that can be a hard fix sometimes. But, yes, it's a common concern. He's talking, but I don't really know what he's saying. Or only the mom knows what they're saying, or just, you know, the primary caregiver might get some of it, but strangers don't have a clue.
Right. And the guidelines for that is parents should understand about 50% of what a toddler is saying by the time they turn two. By the time they turn three, parents should understand most of what a child says, like 90%. And then by age four, strangers should understand most of what a child says. So those are just kind of the broad general guidelines. So if your child falls within one of those categories, he's probably doing okay. I think 50% around age two is pretty typical to understand when a child's speech and language skills are moving along like we would expect. Sometimes the children we see aren't saying anything at two, so it's hard to know whether you can understand them or not based on nothing. But those are kind of the general guidelines that I wanted us to talk about first, because sometimes a parent will say, I hardly understand anything, and then I'll sit and listen, and they are actually getting more than they think they are. They're just so stumped when they get to a word or two that they feel like they don't understand very much, when that's probably not always the case.
Mm-hmm. My experience as well.
Okay, good. This is going to be a boring show if we don't perk it up a little bit.
Okay.
Let's talk about kind of typical speech sound development so that everybody has kind of a good base of reference from that. And let me preface all of this by saying, even though we're talking about specific sounds today and speech intelligibility and making your toddler easier to understand, that still should not be the primary focus for a child's speech and language therapy or developmental intervention, or even just moms at home that aren't doing speech therapy yet with kids. They may just be concerned about it. Worrying about how they sound as a toddler and a young preschooler is not nearly as important as the message that they're communicating or what they're trying to say. So don't take this show or this focus on this today to mean that I think that you should really be over analyzing your children's sounds and really worried about their substitutions or omissions of sounds at this point, because language is the most important thing. And I know you feel the same way.
Absolutely. And Laura, let's just put out there for those folks who aren't familiar with the lingo or the terms, when you're saying intelligibility, I guess
that means how well you're understood, the understandability of your child's speech. So
yeah.
if you're going to rate it percentage-wise, you know, I ask parents all the time to do that. I'll say, how well do you understand him? You know, zero being you don't get a thing that comes out of this kid's mouth. You don't understand mama. You don't understand bye-bye. You don't know milk. You don't understand ball. Nothing. That would be zero. 100% would be like talking to an adult, that you understand absolutely everything that they say. So by two, parents should understand about half of what their children are trying to tell them verbally.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make better sense?
It makes sense. I've had a few parents think that intelligible had something to do with intelligence, and I can see they might. Yeah, I had one mom, an educated mom actually, and she was insulted when a speech therapist said that, you know, he was largely intelligible. And, you know, I think she just saw the first part and thought, what? My child's not intelligent? And then once she, you know, somebody said, well, no, that's really how well they're understood, she
right.
felt silly. But it's, you know, it's not a common term, really, unless you happen to be in the therapy world, and then we hear it a lot. But and then
I'm
if,
glad you brought that up. Yeah,
okay.
That's a great
and then
one.
Another one is if you were working on intelligibility or how well a child is able to, you know, say the sounds as the average person or adult might say them, would you call that you're working on articulation?
Right, and that's
okay.
the jargony term that speech pathologists use for specific sounds and how well you use the correct sound, or if you use a substitution, that might be a kid saying wabbit for rabbit. They substitute the W sound for an R sound. Another kind of speech sound error or mistake that we hear with children is leaving off those consonant sounds altogether. That would be instead of saying mine, they might say my and leave off that final N, or even leave off the M at the beginning, ein for mine.
Mm-hmm.
So you can omit or delete or whatever fancy schmancy term your speech pathologist might want to use. That means leaving off that consonant sound. That's very common. You can also distort it. I think that would be a word that everybody would understand, meaning that you pronounce it like that would be like using a lispy S for a kid that says, you know, my birthday wishes, it would be wishes, or, you know, you really lisp that S or SH. So
mm-hmm.
that would be another kind. And those are the three major kinds of errors that speech pathologists listen for when they're analyzing a child's speech: omissions, leaving the sound off, substitutions, using another sound for the sound that's intended, or a distortion. So those are the big categories. Another thing I wanted to talk about is when consonant sounds generally come in, and that's something that we look for with children because it would not be an error, say, for a new two-year-old, say, you know, 24 months, 26 months, to not be doing a C sound or the K sound in cookie. So for them to say tutti at two is fine because that K and G sound, those consonants made at the back of your mouth, don't really come in sometimes until closer to three. So you've got to also look at those age ranges, and I wanted to talk about when consonant sounds usually emerge.
But I'm just playing devil's advocate today. I'm thinking, now what would a mom think? I think I would say something about so sometimes when they do those sound substitutions, if they're saying tookie for cookie at two, that's fairly normal. It's really
right.
not any reason for concern at all. You just kind of
right.
wait, and as they talk more and get that practice, lots of times it gets better, or, I mean, it gets...
Absolutely, and what
yeah.
happens with children with typically developing speech and language is those sounds come in on their own. They start to fix a lot of those errors without much... notice from their parents at all. So lots of children aren't even corrected. Uh-oh, my fax machine's coming on. Sorry. Hang on 1 second. So in typically developing speech, and again, let's talk about this from last week. Speech means the sounds that you say, the actual consonant and vowel sounds that you hear. Language refers to the words, the vocabulary, the length of your statements, that kind of thing. Today we're really just talking about the speech part. And I've lost my train of thought. What was that? I think I was going to talk about how kind of a real overview of speech sound development.
Okay.
And so babies first start to use lots of vowel sounds. Do you remember when your babies were 6 and 8 weeks old and they would start to really coo when you held them in their laps, and you would say oh or ooh and they would coo back to you?
I do. I didn't know what they called it or anything, but they did it, so I should have been thankful. I just assumed it, and most babies too, but we
most
see babies who
too.
Yeah, a lot of the kids that we work with, mommies say he never really did do that. He never did. And you know, it's not, sometimes they don't even recognize that that's atypical or that that's something
right.
they might be concerned about until they're a year and a half or two and they have no words. And
right.
they
the
think
problem,
back and they think, yeah, they never
yeah.
did that. Mm-hmm.
Well, I was going to say, and the problem really started way back. And I, when I sometimes go in for an evaluation and I'll start talking about a baby's history, and they'll really say, gosh, I didn't even really think about it like that. He never really did any of that cooing or any of that early babbling. And that's the next phase that we're going to talk about. When kids get between 7 and 9 months old, sometimes a little sooner, you really do start to hear the mama, mama, da, 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 ba, 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 ga, 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 ga. All that nice little babbling that happens. I remember our babies would, when they would wake up in the crib, if I didn't go get them soon enough, you know, would start to cry, and you would hear the ma, 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 as they cried. And that is great early sound development. So that typically happens somewhere in the second half of their first year. And the consonant sounds that we typically hear first are the lip sounds. Those would be P's, B's, and M's. And that's why nearly every language in the world has mama, or their version of mama. They probably change the vowel with that, but M is usually always the beginning of that word, because that universally, no matter what language you speak, those sounds typically come in first. The next consonant sounds that usually emerge are N, like no, H, like high, and then W. And all that, those six consonants, most children, or 75% of those children with typically developing speech and language, have mastered all of those consonants by the time that they're two. So P, B, M, N, H, and W. And then the next group of consonant sounds that generally emerge are T's, D's, K's, and G's, and those are in somewhere after that time when they've mastered that first set. And then the later consonant sounds that develop are S, R, L, Z, V, and then a lot of our blends that we think about, like a CH or an SH, the J sound, and then TH is the very last consonant sound that comes in, and that's usually mastered after age 5 or 6. So speech sounds take a long time to emerge. Even in typically developing kids, you'll hear those substitutions for a long time, and that really shouldn't be a huge cause of concern for parents with late talkers, because really you want to focus on the words and not so much the sounds. I just want to give this information today just so that you'll know what normal is.
Laura, I'm looking at your information on your website, which if you're listening, you need to visit the website, because it has great information about speech and language and early childhood development. But there's, I see, I don't know if you said this, I was listening for, I didn't hear it, about the F, and it looks like there's some, call it controversy, but some discrepancy about when an F is typical.
Yeah, some sources say that it's around 2.5, and I do have some kids even that I see that have a good F at 2.5, but most of the time, other sources say that that consonant sound comes in typically between when a kid is 3 and 4 years old.
Yeah, I have a lot of kids who can't do an F, but, you know, we see kids with some speech issues in general. So it looks to me, from what I see, 3 and 4 sounds more reasonable. I have a lot of kids
so
who
too.
Can't get it. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And
anyway.
Well, it's a harder sound anyway. If you think about mm-hmm. it, you've got to get your teeth on your lip. You know, it's kind of an easier sound to work on if you're a preschool speech pathologist and you really are having a hard time picking out speech targets for your kids, because it's one that you can see. You know, I remember when I saw kids that age in graduate school, I liked working on F because I could say, look, put your teeth on your lip. And it's harder to work on some of those other sounds that you can't see as easily.
Yeah, so, I think the K and G are hard, because it's like you're trying to show them and model it, but yet they can't see it. So, yeah.
Yeah, and those are harder sounds. And actually, K and G come in that latter, late 2, early 3, although I see kids without K's and G's as they're turning 3 all the time. That's one really early speech target that lots of preschool speech pathologists work on. And, you know, you and I joke all the time when we have kids that have some of those sound substitutions, we think, oh, we're just going to let that school therapist fix that. We're going to let that therapist that sees this kid after us work on that. We're not working on that right now. We're just going to concentrate on words and on those really early P's, B's, M's, T's, and D's, because those are the ones that children truly should have as they start to really try to say sounds. Those are the consonant sounds that usually that you hear first, and those are the ones that you would want to work on first if you didn't have a child that was able to produce that on his own. Okay.
You know what? Can I do another one? I'm in the Socratic mode. I'm into asking you questions today, so.
Go ahead.
Couple more questions. Now, if you saw a child and they had a few words, or say 10, 20 words, it's a two-year-old, which would be somewhat behind as far as what would be expected, and we've talked about that on previous shows, but they break these rules that you talk about, how, you know, the first sounds are B, P, and M, and then they, you know, it goes along, and what would you think if you saw a child who didn't have any of those lip sounds, but they had those back sounds, the K and the G, or, I mean, does that, do you automatically assume something, or do you just think, boy, that's not the way it usually goes, or what's
that's
your thought
what
process?
That's what I think, is I just think, gosh, that is not typical sound development, and somewhere down the road, we are probably going to have to work pretty hard on getting those sounds in, and by pretty hard, I mean that I would focus on sounds more than I would with a kid that I felt like articulation wasn't going to be a challenge. But the truth is lots of language-delayed children are going to have speech delays as well. They're not going to produce words correctly. They're going to have things that are missing or sounds that are substituted for other sounds, because that's just the nature of speech-language delay. It's not just one system that's messed up. It's kind of the whole thing. But I would just think if a kid was using a K and a G consonant or using some later developing consonants, if they weren't using those lip sounds, that it wasn't emerging like it should, and that we are probably going to have to pay some attention to that, at least in our cueing strategies to get those sounds going.
Mm-hmm. And here's one more.
Okay.
And I know it's very hard to answer these questions, but I'd kind of like to know for my own reference, and I'm sure anybody listening may have a similar thought. I know, because I work with you and have known you a long time and respect what you say, but that you don't work on articulation. Now, we're early interventionists. We work with 0 to 3-year-olds, and I know you do some artic, but not much. You know, you're a language. You work on communication. So if you could say, and I know it's hard to say, but at what age would, if a child is typically developing except for speech, and by that I mean articulation problems, they're difficult to understand and the mom's concerned, what would you say is the average age, if you could say that, where it would be really appropriate to really target how intelligible they are and all those articulation issues?
I think it's after 3, and I'll tell you why. Because so many of a child's abilities to monitor what he said and cognitively to kind of think about himself and think about his mouth and that he has control over those things, so many of those cognitive processes do not come in until a child is turning 3. And so to work on some of this stuff and have it be your sole focus for therapy is absolutely crazy. Because cognitively, a kid is not going to be able to do that until he's closer to 3. And when I went to graduate school, if anybody had said to those professors, you know, who are all as old as the hills then, and then even the people that I went to school with.
Like us now?
Yeah, like us now. Yeah, exactly. 40-ish. Ooh, old.
Bad. Ooh.
I know. But if anybody.
It's much younger than it used to be, however, so that's good.
I know. But if anybody had said then that we would even really sort of analyze a kid's phonetic inventory or the sounds they were using it to, we would have all just said, that's crazy. Why are you doing that? It's way too early to worry about speech intelligibility or articulation until after they're 3. And actually, we never saw kids even in clinic when I was in grad school until they turned 3. Those were the babies. And now, you know, because we do early intervention, I think of a three-year-old as practically grown. You know, and kindergartners are like geriatrics to me now because we work with younger children. You know, we're really analyzing their speech and language much younger, and as we should be. I mean, we do need to be providing these early intervention services for children. I'm not trying to say that we've jumped the gun and that it's not appropriate, but to over-focus on speech before a kid is three actually could be more damaging to a child than good, because at that point you don't want to stifle any language. One thing that also happens with kids that I know that you've seen this too, and it happens with lots of typically developing children too, when they're going to that sentence phase, they start to stutter.
Mm-hmm.
And so you kind of feel like, okay, we've added this other piece in here, and stuttering is very normal for children between 2.5 to 4, again, when they're really learning to kind of go to that sentence level. But children with speech sound production problems who you have over-focused on sounds and over-focused on really the intelligibility piece oftentimes stutter because you've paid too much attention to it. And that's scary when you think, oh, no, I did this to him by making this too big of a deal. They're just mm-hmm. too aware of it, and their little brains are on overload, and you have to, at that point, really, really back off and make it be more fun and make it be more about language than it is about and the words, and actually concentrate on a kid's message rather than how he says a particular word. And so please, I hope nobody misinterprets what we're talking about today as me thinking that we should be sitting down and flipping flashcards and really be in a kid's face and, you know, it's life or death if you don't pronounce this word correctly, because that's not my intent at all. I just want to talk about intelligibility in a general kind of framework. I wanted to give those consonant sounds as a reference at the beginning so that parents could say, oh, my kid's, you know, got an M, a P, a T, a D. Gosh, we're doing pretty well. We're not going to think that's a big deal. That's my whole intent.
Right. Okay.
The article that we're talking about today is on the website at teachmetotalk.com, and it's in the articulation section, and it's called Working Toward Intelligible Speech in Toddlers. And the first, we've already talked about the first part of that, the background, but the next thing is, the next section is called First Targets for Intelligible Speech in Toddlers. And the first point under there is something that I think we started talking about last week. It's, is my child using the correct number of syllables in words? This would be the kid who says, like, ba for ball, balloon, and blanket. You know, you only get that first syllable. Didn't we talk about that last week, like kids that do maybe ma for mama or da for dada?
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
We did.
And so syllableness, or being able to get the correct number of syllables in words, is actually what you should look at with your kids before you start looking at different sounds. Oh, he's substituting the, you know, the P for a D or a P for a T. Actually, it'd be more likely what he would do. You know, don't look at any of that, and don't even focus on that if you've got a kid that's still not able to combine syllables into words. So the syllableness is what that process is called in the real speech terminology, is what you want to look at first. So that would be your first consideration.
That sounds like something I might make up. It doesn't sound like a real
syllableness.
Word. Syllableness.
It's a real word.
You know that syllableness stuff. Yeah, that. Yeah.
You know,
I believe you, but it sounds funny.
Well, and let me tell you where this is from. This is from a phonological processes point of analyzing a kid's speech. And all kids, again, this is so technical today, I almost hate that we're even doing it, but now that I've gone there, we're just going to do it.
Okay.
But syllableness is what really determines how it is the major focus of intelligibility when you're looking at a two-year-old. Because if you've got a kid that's trying, that can't even bump up to a two-syllable word, he is not going to get to phrases. He is not going to get to sentences because he cannot combine two syllables to make a word. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think it does.
Okay. And you've had kids that do buh for bubble.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And the opposite of that, kind of the next little pattern that would come in, is kids would duplicate the syllable. so that's why we have so many words like mama, dada, bye-bye, nana for banana. That kind of process comes in next, where they're able to kind of do the syllables in a row, but it's two that sound exactly the same. And that's actually a good thing. And that's my point. If you have a kid that cannot do the second syllable of a two-syllable word, that's what you need to go for. Instead of doing balloon, you need to be doing bye-bye. Or, again, working on those words that would really help him be able to learn to duplicate that syllable or get that next syllable out.
And it's a good idea sometimes to simplify it so that the child has a fighting chance at popping it out. And, you know, if you're modeling mommy, 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 and your child only says ma or mom, then model mama. So you're kind of bumping it up, but making it something that they might be able to imitate.
Absolutely. I'm so glad you were able to word that in real mom language.
Layman terms? I'm good at layman terms, actually. It's the professional jargon I have a little issue with. Hey, that reminded me. I wanted you to say a little blurb about jargon. You had it in the section above.
I did. I skipped that. Yeah, jargon usually comes in between 12 and 18 months. Jargon is defined as those long strings of sounds that you have no clue what the baby's saying. Blah, 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 blah. I can't even do jargon.
It is hard. I'm not. I mean, I totally know it, but it's hard to imitate.
I know.
It's like they have all these consonants and vowels, and they kind of sound like words,
right. But
there's really no pattern to it, so it's not like they always call, you know, the doggy da-da or da. It's just jibber-jabber, but it kind of sounds like words, and it kind of goes up and down just like words do.
And it's important that kids be able to do that, too, because that is how they learn to do the melody of talking, and that is how they learn to put all those syllables together to make a sentence-length statement. And so jargon is an important thing, but gosh, sometimes when I get a kid that's doing all jargon, I just sit there and think, oh, no. I have no idea. Are these sound substitutions? Is he really trying to talk? Or is it just jibber-jabber, like you said? Most of the kids that we see, it is just jibber-jabber. But sometimes I'll really listen, and I'll think, okay, that was a real word. All right, that was a real word. And then those kids are kind of in between knowing, okay, I've got some real words here, but I'm still kind of stuck in this baby talk or jargon phase.
Right. A lot of the jargony kids I've had, this is not meant as any kind of ethnic slur, but I've had a lot of parents say that, oh, he's speaking Chinese.
Yeah. Yeah. And it is funny when you hear kids like that, because they really do sound like that when you listen. Tyler, our son, who is 16 and a half now, and I'm so glad he's in school and would never listen to the show, so we won't know that I gave this example. Our oldest son's name is Jonathan, and we lived next door when I was in grad school with them to this really nice Chinese couple. But they would yell at the top of their voices in Chinese all the time. Well, Tyler, when he started trying to say Jonathan, would say, nah, nah, really nasally, and we would think, oh, no, his first word approximations are sounding like that. And actually, that probably would have been better than our deep southern dialect, but it was funny, and you can almost hear other little hints of other languages there, but that just tells you all of our languages really do come from kind of a core set of sounds. We just combine them in different ways, and all of us sound different.
And Laura, at what point, if you go to do an assessment or you're working with a child, and is there any point where you've become concerned or it's somewhat atypical or it's not what most kids do when they keep using a whole lot of that jargon?
Jargon really should be replaced by real words, by two. And even in the kids that we see that, you know, of course, there's a problem or we wouldn't be there, I still want to see jargon really going away as we add or just them use it when they don't have another word or when maybe they're mad or, you know, they're trying to tell a really long story and there's no way they have the vocabulary to do that. But really, I like to see jargon fade as we add more real words, and especially when we start to get lots of two-word combinations. I like to see that just kind of go by the wayside, because mm-hmm. jargon in typically developing language is supposed to be just kind of that in-between step. So we want it to be that way. Even if the language is slow to come, we do want it replaced by real words as soon as we can get it replaced. Does that make sense?
It does to me, yeah.
Okay,
Laura, I'm going to do a plug for the call-in because we're halfway through the show and we haven't had a caller yet. So
okay, go ahead.
Please, if you're listening, call in. We love live callers because it gets us away from the speechy stuff. And you can call in about speech, but you can call in about your child or an experience you've had with a therapist or early intervention or a concern you may have that you haven't looked into, or hey, you can call in about a good recipe as far as I'm concerned. But here it is. It's 1-718-766-4332. It's toll-free, so it won't cost you anything. Just call in and say hey. Okay, Laura, go ahead.
Okay, that's great. Okay, so the first thing that we're going to look at when we're looking at intelligible speech in toddlers is, one, is my child using the correct number of syllables in words? The next consideration is my child using correct vowel sounds in words? Because vowels actually give you more information about the word the kid's trying to say than the consonants do. So if you've got a kid who, and remember, vowels are your, think back to when you're learning to read, A, E, I, O, U, and sometimes Y, and most of the time we have long vowel sounds and short vowel sounds, and I won't make it any more lingo-y than that. You know, just think about those kinds of sounds. But you need to fix your vowels and your syllables in words before you even start to think about the consonants. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay.
And by fix it, you mean you would try and address that, try and change that, try and bring that around to what typical kids are doing before you get stuck on those B's, P's, M's, D's,
right.
D's, K's.
Right.
Uh-huh.
Right.
Okay.
Because if you've got a kid that's just only got the which we hear buh, duh, muh, that might be the only vowel sound a kid has, you are going to want to start to work to get some of those vowel sounds before you would even start thinking about the consonant sounds. And that's more important. If you were looking at intelligibility as, okay, I'm going to build the foundation for my kid to talk really plain, first you work on syllables, then you work on vowels. Now, work on, I'm kind of using that out of, I don't really mean work on. I mean, in my mind, I would think, okay, I'm working on this. But how does that look in real life? It looks like you're really, really playing and overemphasizing those vowels. So that would mean that you would have farm animals and do a big, you know, moo to get a different vowel sound. Or ba, ba. Or, you know, your favorite example, Kate, is you make everything slide. So everything is wee. So you're really emphasizing those vowel sounds, and that's what I mean by work on. I do not mean that you get in your toddler's face and say, okay, I say it, you say it. That is not what I mean at all. That is completely inappropriate for a kid under three. I mean you're going to do it in the context of play so that you have whatever toys you're playing with, whatever he likes, and that what I do is try to have me have a similar toy to the kid, and I make my character, animal, or whatever it is, do that little sound while we're playing. And again, it's supposed to be so much fun and so much about play that your kid has no idea that you're trying to get him to say a different sound.
Mm-hmm. And those, we call them environmental sounds, but like almost sound effects, whether you're doing
yeah.
the animal sounds or the weeing, or I use boom a lot. They love those, you know, because they're just, they seem to understand or, you know, like that that's funny. You know, a lot of times if you can model, and they finally do it, they smile and they laugh and they think it's just goofy to them. So, you know.
And it's supposed to be so much fun. Again, and when I'm saying work on, I wish there was some way that I could say play on, or, you know, just I don't want the word work for any parent to think, or a therapist for that matter, to think that it's appropriate for you to be in a toddler's face, or heaven forbid, have them try to sit across from you at a table or something like that when they're two. You know, all these kinds of things need to be done in the context of really, really playing. So,
and Laura, here's something I've never asked you in all of our hours of discussing these topics. Is there, and this may be way too speechy, but I find myself wondering, I'm in that mood today, can you tell?
I can tell, and I'm glad it's perfect for the show.
Is it good? Okay, here's another one. Is there any connection that you're aware of between if a child could say, you know, could get out a long A sound, they could say A. Is there any connection between, is it likely that if a child could do a long vowel sound, they could do a short vowel sound? Or is there any, do you know if, you know, is there a pattern or is it just really child specific?
I think that it's child specific, but I did try to look up some things about vowel sounds a couple of days ago because, you know, right now I'm working on that. I'm finishing up that second DVD, Teach Me to Listen and Obey, which is about comprehension, but I've already started looking at that third one, which is Teach Me to Talk with Apraxia and Phonological Disorders. And as background preparation for that DVD, I was looking up some stuff on vowels. And let me tell you, the stuff that I've found is so technical, I can't even read it. And I'm interested in this stuff, and I like it. And so it's so technical to me that I think I'm just going to pull back a little bit and not try to look at some of that. Most of it has to do with your mouth position. So if you think about, you know, front vowels, you know, they're made, or, you know, more central vowels, kind of where they're made in your mouth. Does that make sense to you? So if you've got a vowel that you can make toward that's, you look at what other vowels are made in the same position, and those should be the next ones that you do. Do you see what I'm saying with that?
Yeah. So like if your mouth moved one way to make a sound, the likelihood is that if it was a similar movement with your mouth, you might be able
to
say it. But if it's very different, it might not be a sound they could get. Yeah, we talked a little bit about that, like the long E. And I seem to have a slew of kids who can't get a long E out to save their soul right now. So I'm very aware of that E thing. But
I know, and you really can work on that one because that is one kids can see. But in my vowel research, let me find the sticky note that I did. Okay, the vowel that's the easiest to do, of course, is like a U. And then the hardest ones, according
to
this. How
about
Well, it's the same vowel.
Yeah, I have a lot of kids who are really good at that.
That's the only darn sound they can make.
That's it, pretty much.
Okay,
yep.
The hardest vowels, and again, before when I'm saying central vowels, mid vowels, I might have. That's so technical. We're not. They may be called something different now. That's what they were called in the late 80s and early 90s when I went to school. I'm going to do more research about this whole vowel stuff and read the most current things coming out about that. But my point is, the easiest one is The next easiest ones are long O, and ow. Think about ouch, ouch, ow. How many times do you have kids that can say that? A U is an easier one to do, and I have a ball when I'm telling a kid, you know, I want you to do it. You do it. You. That's a fun one to practice.
I said, use your big fish lips. You.
Yeah, that's a great cue for that. And then long A. Now, those are supposed to be the next easiest ones. And then I skipped over a couple of more categories and didn't write them down because I remember them looking at it on the website I was looking at, but then I just wrote down the most difficult ones are long E, like E, like we've been talking about, short E, which is like an eh, and then long I. You know, I do it. That's my I. Or if you're in Mississippi, I. So those are supposed to be the more difficult vowels. So that would make sense with the kinds of kids and the difficulties that we see with kids because E is kind of a harder one for some kids to get. But then again, you really can work on that one because you can get right in their little faces and really model, you know, cheese, eat, please. And they can see you do that, and you can even take your hands if they'll let you and help them stretch out their little lips so that they're making that sound.
Okay.
Are you still
gotcha. Okay. Yeah, I'm listening.
Okay, so let's get back to our kind of building our foundation here. We're going to look at the correct number of syllables in the word. Then we're going to look at the vowel sounds. Then we're going to make sure a kid can combine two different vowel sounds in a word. And again, that's back to that reduplication process when he can only use a sound or the same sound in the next syllable in a word. And then after you make sure your kid can do all that, that's at the point that you start really kind of analyzing those consonant sounds. So, again, what does this mean for some mom that might be listening who has a kid with only 10 or 20 words? It may be a long, long, long time before you ever get to look at these things because, one, you may not get past that first one or two, and you shouldn't really be worried about consonant sounds yet if you still have a kid that can't get a couple of different syllables put together. And then back to our original point with this is if your kid isn't caught up or making really good progress in the number of words that he's saying, you know, articulation or these sounds shouldn't even be a focus at all.
Yeah, it's really kind of self-defeating because if you get stuck on you want it to sound just right or a little clearer, or, you know, then you if and I see this happen in the real world with well-intentioned speech therapists, but they get stuck on it needs to come out clearly, and kids just get mad and get quiet, you know. And so instead of getting better, they just quit talking. So,
and who can blame them at that point? Because if you have somebody trying to correct every single sound that comes out of your mouth, that would be horrible. It would be totally frustrating. And I think a lot of kids do just think, why bother? If it's not going to be good enough for you, tell you what, I just won't say it at all.
And sometimes even when I had a little guy do this to me today. I'm a DI, not a speech therapist, but sometimes I see pretty speechy kids for lack of speech therapist. And I was trying to encourage certain sounds, and he did it once, and I said, "Say it again, tell me." And I'm trying to be fun and playful, and he said, "No."
Oh.
No. I don't matter how much fun you are, when they mean no, they really do mean no. So that means I've pushed too hard. You know, if he's shutting down like that, better to have him try it once or twice than not at all. Or the better to have him try the next word I'm trying to get him to say than to just say, forget it. And I
know,
I
or you set up a situation where he has to say it again to get what he wants, but again, it's in such a playful way that he doesn't even realize he's trying it.
Right.
So that's what you do. You know, one other thing, since this is supposed to be about what's important and what's not with speech intelligibility, to be more intelligible, you need the consonant sound at the beginning of a word than you would the end of a word. And how many times do you hear speech pathologists who, with a brand new 2-year-old, are so hyper-focused on getting that kid to say the ending sound in a word, they either, one, miss their intent that they're trying to say to you, so they miss the whole language piece, and then, two, they might ignore all these other worse problems that would actually be worse for their intelligibility than just getting that final consonant sound.
Right.
And I take over for a lot of, I'm kind of the replacement speech therapist for a lot of people or a lot of kids. You know, a parent might have blown through 2 or 3 people trying to find a good fit, and that is always one of the things that a mom will say to me is, you are never trying to make him say that ending consonant sound. And that last girl, that's all she did. She drove him crazy. All she could think about when he's saying words is saying truck, truck, truck.
Right.
You know, and when you think about it, a lot of those kids, I think, gosh, there's so many more things we need to work on before we get hyper-focused on getting that ending consonant sound. And final consonant sounds in typically developing kids sometimes don't emerge till almost 3. So it's really not even an error or wrong, even when a speech pathologist is analyzing a 2-year-old's language, not to have ending consonant sounds. So that should not be a big deal at all for most of the parents that are listening to our show.
Right. And the other thing is, just in practical terms, if they're getting the beginning consonant sound out, usually if you're familiar with them at all or you've been around young children, you can pretty much determine what they're trying to tell you. You know, hat, you know that's hat most of the time. But if they're only giving you the end of the word, it's a lot harder, you know, and some kids will do that. Yeah.
And that's what I mean by if your kid doesn't have consonant sounds at the beginning of a word, that's a much more serious error or serious thing for you to devote some attention to, again, in the context of play, than if he didn't have sounds at the end. And, you know, this has just been a terribly technical show. I hope we don't lose a lot of people through this, but I feel like it's important information. And my biggest thing with this is if you are working with your kid on speech intelligibility and are doing lots of final sounds or trying to work on something like F's or S's or CH's, you know, just stop. They are not ready for that yet. You need to go back. And again, the reason I presented all the information on what comes in first and what comes in second, and really think about speech as a foundational skill. Now, that's not to say that some kids, like you were talking about earlier, don't have a K and a G, and you know they're really kind of funky in the sound systems that they use. Well, then we're going to take those kids, we're going to work with what they have while we try to get all these other little sounds to come in during play. But don't spend a lot of your time and energy working on things that even other children your own kids' age don't even have yet. You know, it's just or really kind of over, like working on stop. I had a parent 2 weeks ago really sitting trying to get her little girl to do stop, you know, an S and a T together. And I said, wait a minute, whoa, back up. And she said, well, 2 weeks ago you were trying to get her to put S on the ends of words. And I said, yeah, because I heard her do a plural, and I know she can do it, and that's why we were working on it. But just because they can do it in one position doesn't always mean they can do it in another position. So the reason that I presented all this is there really is a logical sequence to how some of this stuff comes in, and I just think sometimes that parents are working on the wrong things and that you really need to be working on language first. And if you have a kid who's really, really hard to understand, then look at it from this perspective. Okay, does he have syllables? Okay, can he combine syllables to, you know, form a two-syllable word? Are his vowels correct? You know, these are the things that you need to look at first. And by the way, sometimes they don't even really teach you this in your master's program. So much of that darn stuff about speech intelligibility just focuses on the consonants, and for kids that are two, you know, there's a whole lot that's got to happen before you get to that level.
Right. I think it's also, I was thinking, you know, going back to that working on it and, you know, how you have always emphasized, and I certainly try to make it so playful and fun so that a child doesn't know they're working on it, and I think
right.
You kind of have to think about developmentally, two-year-olds are largely selfish beings.
Yeah.
You know, they're kind of about what they want and
it's
what
about
is
them.
There.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is everything is mine.
Right.
And that's, you know, that's totally normal, but words, using words really is very rewarding because they tend to be able to request and demand what they want, and generally as adults we accommodate them and they get it. But the clarity of speech or the intelligibility of speech probably doesn't mean that much to a two-year-old. You know, it's like,
yeah.
I said ball, I said
cat.
Yeah,
why didn't you understand
cat?
It? That's your problem. Yeah,
so focus on what they're kind of naturally driven to do, and that's to communicate verbally, but not necessarily so clearly that the average stranger would understand them, and you're going to have a lot more success.
Absolutely, and keeping it fun and playful, even if you're working on overall helping them expand their range of sounds. Okay, I wanted to talk about this, and I'm just going to talk about it for about 60 seconds. And there's an article on the website about it at teachmetotalk.com, and if you'll notice, I've gotten a bunch of gripey little responses.
Uh-oh,
from
here we go.
Therapists.
Maybe we'll get a caller on this one.
Yeah,
come on, call in.
But
yeah.
There's so much research in the past 3 or 4 years that's really coming out that oral motor exercises are non-speech oral motor exercises. And in real words, that means having your kid wiggle his tongue back and forth or pop his lips or blow or suck through straws, any kind of little exercise like that that's not paired with the sound is not really going to be effective in helping his speech get clearer. And there are tons of articles to support that now. Dr. Gregory Loft, I've forgotten where he is. He's somewhere in Boston. It's like Massachusetts. It's MGH, Institute of Health Professions in Boston.
Okay.
Did some presentations back in 2006 and 2007. And he's got just, probably 20-plus studies in these articles that have said that those kinds of exercises, without speech sounds are not effective at all in helping children talk clearer. So if you have a speech pathologist that's having you do a lot of that, you're going to really want to talk with her about what the purpose of that is, because there's so much controversy in our field about that. And as a parent, you just need to know that that might not be the best way for you to spend your therapy time. Now, that's not to say that oral motor awareness, or, you know, having a kid realize, oh my gosh, these are my lips and I can purposefully control how they move. You know, that's not to say that that information is not important. And for kids who have such sensory issues, that, like a lot of low tone kids, and Kate, I know you've seen kids like this, that have, sometimes you think, do you even know you have a tongue? Do you mm-hmm. even know that that's in there? You know, those kinds of kids probably do need for you to do some things that really point out and help them develop that awareness. But again, it needs to be done playfully. It needs to be done in the context of, we're going to do this for just a second, and then we're going to move on to getting that same kind of movement and speech. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and I mean, don't you generally pair those movements, whether it's a or a or whatever, with the sound?
You know, I totally
do
them.
Yeah, if you're going to work on how they're moving their mouth, you're going to make, and it might just be a long vowel sound, or, you know, it might not be a whole real word, but it's a sound. And again, then it's meaningful to them. I mean, open your mouth and make a circle and do nothing really doesn't mean much to a 2-year-old. You know,
yeah,
No, what does it get them? Nothing.
I know. Or, you know, I have had kids, you know, I try to see if they can lateralize their tongues, which means, you know, wiggle it from side to side. But really, again, you're just kind of looking, when I do that in the context of an evaluation, I'm looking at their muscle tone, which, by the way, we're going to talk about low tone versus high tone in 2 weeks, when our good friend Michelle Wilder, who's a physical therapist, is going to come on and educate us all about that. But again, if your speech pathologist is doing it to kind of analyze what's going on with your kid's mouth, that's totally different than trying to spend 20 minutes getting him to copy a movement that they may not even need for sounds. And sometimes, again, this is back to my wiggling his tongue, you don't make one darn sound by moving your tongue from side to side in your mouth. There is no sound that's made with that movement. So to practice that over and over and over doesn't really make any sense.
Right. You know, I was hoping we were going to have a call in from our buddy Melanie, who's a speech therapist and used to work here in the Kentucky Anna area, but she's moved to Columbus. But she didn't call, so I'm going to say what she told me about, because I told her you're going to be talking about using those oral motor exercises how research doesn't really support that at this point. But she's younger than we are, I guess.
Yeah.
I shouldn't say, but she's approaching 30, I believe. And she went to Indiana University, and she said, oh, the woman who's the head of the speech department at IU, her name is, I assume, Dr. Karen Forrest, is, a leading researcher in exactly that topic, how using those oral motor exercises with non-speech sounds does not lead to intelligible speech or improved, you know.
Right.
And anyway, so I wanted to give her name. I haven't researched her myself, but I think we need to, so that we know what she says. Oh, she's, you know, she's really big on that, and she's done a lot of landmark research. And so she said,
give her name again.
Dr. Karen Forrest.
Okay.
And she said that when she went to school, which was however long ago, 8 years ago, they really didn't teach the speech therapist, they did not push that at all. So I kind of wonder if it's kind of an age thing. I mean, we're older than she is. It's something that I hear a lot of speech therapists talk about at meetings, you know, as the whole early intervention process is getting started, and they're talking about what they're going to be doing. And, you know, later on down the road, parents will say, Johnny won't, she's tried some of that, but he won't do any of that.
Surprise, surprise.
Yeah, he just gets mad, and she holds a mirror, and she tries to get him to say it in the mirror, and he got mad, and he threw the mirror. And I always kind of think, well, you know, I say, oh, but what I really kind of think is, well, that's because he's too little to do that.
Totally too little. And again, now the research or in the past few years, the research is telling us that it's not really productive anyway. But let me tell you, I have stepped on some toes writing about that on the website, and if you know, gotten quite a few comments and made people mad about that. Now, on the other hand, there are people that say, thank you for putting this out there. I haven't had a way to really word it in real people language so that I could give this information to parents that I see. So, again, it's kind of a controversial topic, but for me, with working with toddlers, it's not really that controversial because I can't get them to do that darn stuff anyway.
And if Laura can't get them to do it, you can forget anybody else because she can make anything fun. But really, that just isn't fun.
Yeah, it's not fun and it's not appropriate. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to spend too much more time talking about that. I just want you to know that there's an article on the site. You can read it for yourself. And again, your speech person may really get her toes stepped on if you're talking about that with her, because some people truly, truly believe in it. And there is a place for that if your child is having feeding problems or other things. But using those kinds of exercises so that you can get more intelligible speech, is the research is telling us that it's not effective anyway. So, again, I want to use my therapy time to help parents find out things that are effective. And the stuff that we talked about today, again, was just a general reminder with what's important and what's not important when you're looking at how well you understand your kid. And more important than any of that silly speech stuff is, are they trying to talk? Are they trying to say words? Are they making their needs known even with gestures? And you've got to get that communication piece in before you even start to think about the specific sounds that they have.
Yep.
Are you there?
I'm with you.
I get a little nervous when I say something like that and pause and you're not.
I'm not going to hang up. I just don't have anything to add to that, which is, you know, that's good. I usually have too much
unusual,
to add.
Unusual, but good.
Yeah, that's good. I'm just saying, uh-huh, yeah, I totally agree.
Yeah, and let me give some real quick tips. This other thing that we learned from this great speech pathologist, David Hammer, who is from Pittsburgh, and we talked about him a couple of weeks ago on a show. He works a lot with children with apraxia, but he had this great set of cueing things. You know, he calls his, I don't know what he calls his M, I can't remember, but that gave us.
You know, he changes it, motor sound and then humming sound.
Well,
I like motor sound
it
better.
I don't use
motor
sound. I use my good sound because I do that little you know, because I feed kids every time I see them and have snack. And that's, I use that. But my point about that is, if you're a speech pathologist and listening to this, or if you're a parent, you know, and you're working with a speech pathologist, pick up on some of those little sound cues, because calling those, you really can't say to a two-year-old, you need to use your M sound. What the heck is an M? What does that mean, you know, when you're two? So sometimes coming up with those little cues is a great way to, when you do start thinking about intelligibility, you know, close to three or after three, to really help your kids kind of internalize what that sound feels like and how it sounds. And that was my point about that. I am going to talk about those kinds of sound cues in our third DVD, Teach Me to Talk with Apraxia and Phonological Processing, and I'm probably going to put those on the website at some point too, with what all those little cues are. P is like your popper sound, pa, pa, pa. And I know you use those sound cues too, Kate, and kids really respond to that. And again, I think that's the most technical and the most focus you should ever have on speech, is to give a little cue like that, try to get it in a word, and then move on for it to be more about the vocabulary and more about how a kid is using that. It should only, those little cues should just really be brief, and again, not a major focus for your therapy time.
Right. The other thing that David Hammer talked about, which
you've got,
you
one
know,
minute.
I have. Okay. Well, was.
And if Kate doesn't get through with her explanation, you can always listen to
it. I have 2 minutes, I do believe, but it wasn't terribly important.
The board says 1 minute, but go ahead.
Okay, well, I'll skip it. It's probably too picky anyway. So go ahead, give a closer, whatever.
No,
you didn't get the pacifiers and sippy cups, and that's kind of important. Were you thinking?
That's kind of an important thing. And
okay,
we
go
talk
there.
About that a little bit. Well, pacifiers do not keep kids from talking. Pacifiers are an important regulatory tool for lots of children. I know some speech pathologists come in, and the first minute that they're there, they say, well, no wonder he's not talking. He's got his passy in his mouth all day. That generally is not the reason your kid is not talking. So, again, there's an article on the website, using sippy cups and pacifiers, will they hurt or help my late talking child? If you have a child with lots of sensory issues, you may need that passy. So don't feel guilty about that, and don't feel like that's the reason that he's not talking. Now, that being said, you probably don't need it in 24/7, and as they're over two, you really do want to start to reduce the time to maybe sleeping or when they need it to calm down. Lots of times after I've really worked with a kid for an hour and get him all hyped up, he needs a passy in that calm down time after speech. That's one thing. And then sippy cups, actually the research is telling us, do more harm for children's teeth than even pacifiers do, prolonged sippy cup use. So if you have, if you're a parent who's worried about that, getting on a straw cup is going to do more for him dental-wise and more for him to help his muscles in his mouth mature than taking the passy out. So sippy cups are actually worse than passies are, according to some research. So thanks so much for listening today with Teach Me to Talk with Laura and Kate. We'll be back next Friday at 1 o'clock. And please call. We had no callers today.
Yeah, if you're just listening, Ren, it's recorded. Call us next Friday, 1 o'clock Eastern Time.
Yeah, we'd love to hear from you. Thanks so much.
Thanks.
Bye.
Bye.